Hey, listeners, KJ here. If you're in with us every week, you're what I like to call people of the book. And some of us book people discover somewhere along the way that not only are we writers, we're people with a gift for encouraging other writers. Maybe that comes out in small ways for you, but for some of you, it's a calling and an opportunity to build a career doing work you love. Our sponsor, Author Accelerator, provides book coaching to authors, like me, but also needs and trains book coaches. And if that's got your ears perked up, head to authoraccelerator.com and click on Become a Book Coach.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, trying to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing. Hashtag Am Writing is the podcast about writing all the things. Short things, long things, fictional things, non-fictional things, something in between kinds of things, which I don't know that we really recommend. It depends on where you're writing for. But in any case, as regular listeners know, and any new listeners are about to find out, this is the podcast about figuring out how to sit down and get your work done.
I'm Serena Bowen. I only write long things and fictional things. I'm the author of 30-odd romance novels, and my newest one is called Heartland. You can find all about it at serenabowen.com.
I feel like the things that we write are feeling particularly long this week. I don't know about
right.
you, but I feel like I only write really long things that somehow don't have enough words. Yeah. But they sure feel long to me. I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of my first novel. My debut novel is The Chicken Sisters, coming out in June of 2020. And I'm also the former lead editor and columnist for the New York Times of The Motherlode and the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, which is out in hardback now and will be out in paperback this summer. And I am delighted to say that we have a guest today, and this is going to be a really fun, if somewhat fictionally focused, episode. Today, we are joined by Kathleen Smith, a therapist and writer and the author of Everything Isn't Terrible, a helpful and, I can vouch for this, humorous guide to shedding our anxious habits and building a more solid sense of self in our increasingly anxiety-inducing world, which is brilliant. And we love it, and we are working away at our own anxieties, but we've actually asked Kathleen here today to talk about the anxieties we have more control over, the anxieties of our fictional characters. In other words, we're going to talk about creating believable, dysfunctional characters and families and then helping them to grow and change and get better. Welcome.
I'm so excited to talk about this topic with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for suggesting it and coming. We think this is fantastic. It's so funny because as I read Everything Isn't Terrible, and I have been, I sort of flick between, oh, wait, I need this. Oh, wait, my character needs this. Oh, wait, I do this with my mother. Oh, wait, does my character? Yeah, it's, I think I need to read it. I just need to read it twice, once in each guise. So how did you think of the idea of using a therapeutic formula, a therapeutic lens to view fictional characters?
Well, first of all, I'm a huge fangirl and I love reading books and watching TV shows with complex families, right? You know, everyone these days is obsessed with Succession, right? Or The Crown, or these sort of glamorous dysfunctional families, right? But I as a therapist, I'm a firm believer that everyone's family is just as interesting. if you'd sort of take a dive in and look at the rich sort of emotional history of a family. So I love seeing it in real life and I love seeing it in fiction too, especially when it's done really well.
Which fictional families in print have you enjoyed recently? I was so curious about this.
Yeah, well, one thing I'm reading right now is I'm rereading Emma because, the new movie is coming out. So it's interesting to see some of the family dynamics in that and, sibling position. And I think Jane Austen in particular does such a wonderful job bringing out those differences and the dynamics of people. So that's one thing I'm enjoying right now.
You used another Jane Austen example with us, which was just sort of to get right deep into it. You were talking about how spouses tend to be at the same level of emotional maturity, even though they might express it differently. And you gave the example of the Bennets in Pride and Prejudice, and that just made me laugh because I've read multiple, not just, I've read Pride and Prejudice many times, but also multiple, recreations of it recently. That happens to be a trope that I love. And yes, absolutely, that's exactly, I'd never thought of it that way, but they're both equally awful. It's just that one of them is awful in a more appealing kind of way.
Absolutely. You know, and I think we like to think that we're more mature than our spouses, but at least the theory I was trained in, that is not the case. We tend to be attracted to people who are at the same level of emotional maturity. So I think that's important to think about when you're creating characters in a marriage or in a relationship, what that kind of reciprocity is, you know, and how that sort of fits together. Like just you said, that one person might be seen as the problematic one, right? But that's right. Often not the case.
We are going to think of this firmly from a fictional perspective. And yeah, let's dig into that. So we've got, maybe we've got two romantic leads and we're seeing one of them as the problem. You know, one of them is not returning phone calls or is not living up to expectations or has done, but it's important that they both have sort of equal level of flaws is what I'm hearing you saying.
Yeah, I mean, you could have, and this is such a classic relationship thing, you could have one person who's the distant one, right? And then one person who's sort of the anxious pursuer. And mm-hmm. we interpret one as necessarily having the problem, but they're both caught up in this sort of anxious dance of trying to relate to one another, right? Or trying to get away from the anxiety. Or another classic example is like one person is an overfunctioner, right? And they take on all the responsibility and do everything. And the other person is seen sort of as a slacker, right? Or the lazy one, but they're just responding to the other person's behavior. So it's definitely a two-person dance.
This also makes me think of a trope that I see in romance all the time that I'm not a huge great fan of, which is the crazy ex.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes you get sort of cheap conflict in a romantic plot arc because somebody has a crazy ex. But it's really hard to write a good crazy ex without painting your hero or heroine as kind of an idiot for staying with that person in the first place.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to have them be sort of at different levels of functioning. They probably wouldn't have been together in the first place if that were the case.
Yeah, I mean, you can always make a case for somebody experiencing a lot of growth since they originally
sure.
got together with that person. But yeah, it's hard. One time I was writing a book 3 with my collaborators, and we already knew from books 1 and 2 who the hero and heroine of book 3 were, and this romance had a lot of potential already, but we realized as we were sitting down to plot it that both characters came from really wonderful, stable families. And we sort of looked at each other and went, uh-oh, we're in so much trouble.
Yeah, let's talk about how that family background matters. I mean, why can't we create a book around two people from wonderful, stable homes who've been supported and loved and had only good experiences all of their lives? Besides, yeah, because they don't exist.
Well, you know, in my book, I use that well-known Mary Carr quote that a dysfunctional family is any family with two people in it, right? Or it's something like that. So I don't know if such a thing exists, first of all. you know, there's always some amount of anxiety and dysfunction in any family. But, you know, it's much more interesting and it's much more rich to sort of go back a generation or two and ask yourself, what are the processes at work here? You know, is this a family that avoids each other and distances, and that's how they deal with everything? Is this a family that cuts people off the second they disagree with them or do something scandalous? Or is this a family who's all in each other's business and is constantly, you know, doing things for people that they can do for themselves? You know, it's interesting to think about what some of those patterns might be, and then all of a sudden you have kind of set the stage for your character to kind of emerge from that. And that can influence then how they are in their romantic relationships or in their work or with their own family. So just by doing that sort of homework ahead of time, you have such a great jumping off point for creating conflict and plot.
Sometimes it feels like it's really hard to do that ahead of time and you have to kind of wade in first.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why it's useful to know your own family really well, first of all. It can be an inspiration or other people's to kind of get you curious about that. But, you know, just taking the time to kind of draw that out and draw a little diagram or just some facts can be really useful.
Well, you suggested four different sort of family patterns. Let's talk about those and how we might be able to use them in fiction.
The first one is distance. That's sort of the most obvious things that we do as humans when we're nervous or upset or stressed, right? Like we just get out of there as quickly as possible. But there's also emotional distance, right? So is a family only talking about the weather or sports or very superficial things as a way of managing sort of the underlying anxiety? And then the second one is conflict, which is a little weird because at first glance you don't think, well, conflict doesn't manage anxiety, right? Like, doesn't that cause anxiety? But if I'm convinced that someone is wrong all the time, then that calms me down a little bit. It's actually adaptive. So a lot of families use conflict and sort of focus on one person as the problem, right, to calm them down. And I think that's so useful in fiction because it sort of helps you see that just the person who is identified as having the problem isn't the only player here, right? Everyone is contributing to that in their own way. And you want me to keep going?
No, I'm thinking about that
sure,
one.
Sure, sure.
So yeah. The conflict one, I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about in the romantic relationship where from a fictional point of view, you can draw a picture that looks like one person is the problem. And what is going to evolve is that the people who are making that person the problem are also the problem.
Exactly. Everyone is contributing, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's the good point is you can't look at a person sort of and tell how mature they actually are because, you know, everyone is sort of propping up other people. And so one person in a family might be doing really well and they might have a stable job and seem like a healthy person, but it's because they're directing all their attention onto fixing a kid, right? Or a sibling or a parent, right? It all sort of gets diverted to this one person who gets identified as the problem. Mm-hmm. So that's what's so great about humans is we're just such tricky, complex, you know, creatures. You can't necessarily take at face value how mature a person is and how they're going to act in crisis. You know, people who are actually much less mature than we think we are.
And how does that dynamic play out on the other side, the person who is sort of constantly being fixed?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting into like Jess territory with her writing about parents focusing on kids. But you know, the idea is that if you tell a person that there's something wrong with them or there's something to be anxious about, they start to believe it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's useful for them too to fall into that role and to play that role to kind of keep things stable. Because that is, you know, but that doesn't mean that they won't have problems. You know, they might develop more of the symptoms or more of the problems because everyone in that family is anxiously focused on them.
So what I'm hearing is that it's worth, like, everyone in the story is invested in keeping the status quo, even if the status quo is crappy.
Yes, and that's such a great plot turning point as well, because if that person gets sober or starts doing better or acts differently, it throws everybody off. You think that they want the person to get better, but then they start doing things differently and it changes the whole system. It changes all of the dynamics, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's such an interesting thing to play around with when, okay, what if the person who's seen as the problem child or the problem spouse starts doing better? That is a great sort of turning point for shaking things up because people don't like it. They will push back, you know? And it's really fascinating to see or to read about.
Okay. So that was two two dysfunctional family tropes. What else you got?
Yeah. Well, the other one is very classic. It's overfunctioning and underfunctioning. And so this plays out a lot in marriages especially, but can also with parents and kids or with siblings. You know, who is the person who is becoming over-responsible in times of stress, right? They are doing things for others that they could do for themselves. You know, and who is the under-functioner? They're letting the other person take on that responsibility, and that sort of ends up, you know, the under-functioner is often a person who might develop, you know, substance abuse problems or other issues because they're sort of in that one-down position. And so, you know, based on your sibling position, right? Like, so if your mother was an over-functioner and her mother was an over-functioner, you know, you're really going to get it, right? If you're the firstborn, that's probably going to be your role. And, or if you had a parent who was always overfunctioning for you, you might be a little bit less capable. And so that's kind of an interesting thing to play around with. And if you're looking at a family you're creating and saying, okay, who are the overfunctioners here? And how do they get in the way of everyone else kind of growing up a little bit?
Does it work like horoscopes where overfunctioners are more likely to be drawn in relationships to slackers, or I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
Or are they drawn to other overfunctioners, or could it just be anything?
Oh no, yeah, it's reciprocal, right? So it's the two people participating in the dynamic. So,
so you might have an overfunctioner within their family, and they're drawn to someone who's an underfunctioner within their family.
Well, if you're talking a romantic relationship,
yeah, I was talking romantically.
Yeah, definitely, that works a lot. Two overfunctioners are probably going to butt heads a lot. So you could still write that in a romance, right? Absolutely. But it would be an added challenge because both people are trying to care for each other and help each other, and that causes issues.
Hmm.
That sounds fun to me, actually. Like the butting heads is often a really, you know, terrific romantic conflict.
Absolutely. Yeah. And well, if we're going to talk about siblings later, too, that's another thing. If you have two oldest children, right? They're probably gonna be that way. So it's an interesting dynamic. But yeah, so the if we want to move on, the fourth one is triangles. And everyone knows about triangles, right? It's human nature when two people are tense to pull in a third person or to focus on a third person to calm things down. So it's not just a love triangle. It's sort of the ways that we use other people to calm down our relationship with another person. And those are fun to, if you're drawing a family diagram or a genogram, to sit down and ask yourself, what are the triangles in these family? Is it two siblings against a parent? Is it a parent who's using a sibling to talk to another sibling? You know, is it two parents and a child? The example I love to give, it's from television, but, you know, everybody's pretty familiar, I think, with the show Everybody Loves Raymond. You know, mm-hmm. It's been a while since it was on, but I think most people are familiar with it. And there's this classic triangle in it, right? Between the mother-in-law, Marie, the son, Raymond, and the wife, Deborah, right? And mm-hmm. Everyone thinks that the conflict is between Deborah and Marie, right? The mother-in-law and the daughter. But, you know, Ray is actually quite, you know, whether he realizes it or not, it's actually quite manipulative because he is able to stay out of the conflict by putting it on the two of them. But, and he, you know, his stance is, oh, this issue's between you guys, right? But it's actually, he's actually contributing to it by being a part of the triangle and by saying he has nothing to do with it. And so it's so interesting to kind of play around with and see how these dynamics with three people could be interesting, because when the idea is that when two people are getting along, the third person feels like they're left out, and they'll try and butt in and cause conflict. But if two people are having a fight, the third person doesn't really want to be involved in it, right? They're, the safe place is kind of on the outside. So that's just another fun family dynamic or relationship.
Or you might have a third person who's trying to fix it.
Exactly.
Or you, yeah. Or a mediate. Third person who's trying to make it worse.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's neat. This is an interesting thing to think of from a fictional perspective, because I feel like we often sort of have a thing, you know, a conflict or a plot point or something that's happening, and we've only looked at the point of view of maybe the two main players, and mm-hmm. to always think, well, who's the third player here? It's a different approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And who's maybe trying to give them advice or calm things down? And it can be a positive thing. It's not necessarily negative. But there's usually always more than two people involved when there's conflict.
So it sounds like from there we should start, you know, taking a look at the siblings in our people's relationships. Like, or even if we weren't thinking of a sibling as a big player in a plot, it sounds like we better know who the siblings are and how they play out.
Yeah, and that's one of the most interesting questions you can ask is, what is the person's position in their family? And how does that inform how they are in all other relationships, you know? Sibling position is definitely a part of it. There's actually this other cool book I would recommend to listeners. This guy named Walter Toman in the 60s did this huge study where he interviewed people about their sibling positions. And he wrote this book about what other people they would match well with in a romantic relationship and who they'd be friends with and who they'd get into fights with and sort of what their careers would be, you know. And it's such a cool resource. The only issue is it was written in the 60s, right? So it's only talking about straight couples and women aren't assumed to have careers, right? So you kind of have to take that into account when you're reading it. But it's almost like kind of reading in a horoscope in a way, right?
But
it's just so interesting to me because I love reading them to people to see if their spouse, you know, or other people in their life match with it based on this description.
What is the book?
It's called Family Constellations.
Okay. And it sounds very horoscopey.
It does, right? But it's interesting. You know, the idea is that oldest and youngest tend to pair well together. You know, oldest and oldest tend to butt heads a little bit. And youngest and youngest kind of just faff about and don't know what to do a lot of the time. and obviously there's lots of exceptions and lots of happy marriages despite these things. But it can play a role, you know. And so it's interesting to read these and think about whether they could be useful when you're creating characters. Yeah, it's just an interesting resource I would recommend to people. But it's not just your sibling position. It's what was happening in your family around the time you were born, right? So, you know, on a serious note, say like a woman had, you know, a stillbirth or multiple miscarriages, right, before the birth of a child. That child is probably going to get a little bit more of an anxious focus when they're born, right? Because of all the things that have
happened. Definitely.
Or if there's just been a death in the family, right? There's just more anxiety in the air. And so they might have a little bit of a harder time kind of growing up and being an individual because that is sort of one extra challenge that they have, you know. Or is it a younger sibling and the parents are a lot older and so they're just kind of, you know, more just kind of doing whatever and are more sort of laissez-faire in their parenting, right? Or is it, you know, six boys and one girl, right? How is that girl treated differently in the family and how is her role different? And it's not just the sibling position too, it's your parents' sibling positions, right? I mentioned this earlier, like if this is the oldest of an oldest of an oldest, right? They're really going to like to be in charge and they're probably going to be an overfunctioner, right? You know, and it's interesting to kind of play around with it and think about those positions.
You know who I feel is really good at writing these relationships is the novelist Kristen Higgins.
Yeah.
She uses siblings a lot. And she does this wonderful thing where she is able to use all of this family position stuff and then at the end of the book subvert it. So that the sister that you weren't expecting to really be there in the clinch is the one who makes the difference.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but she does it in a very believable way. So it's not as if she's throwing away those tendencies, but rather, you know, the exception proves the rule kind of manipulation. It's pretty neat.
Well, that's kind of the point of what we're like trying to do here is to see where our characters start out and then pull them to a different place. Right? So we want, you know, we want the character who, maybe without sort of saying it in so many words, but who looks at their distancing relationship with their family and goes, okay, I'm going to stop I'm going to stop hiding. I'm going to stop not talking. I'm going to change and grow. And then, yeah, it's the relationships of the other people around them. But it's that protagonist's, you know, where they start and where they end that matters for the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good question to ask if you're thinking about, okay, how do I create a disruption too? Is anytime someone is doing the opposite of what they would normally do to calm things down, that's when you get the shakeup. That's when you get the pushback, the initial pushback, right? Like, it might help things in the long run, but temporarily it's going to increase the anxiety and maybe increase the conflict a little bit. So that's a wonderful question to ask, is what does my character normally do in stressful situations or when they are anxious? And can I create a situation where they do the opposite? And what is everyone's response to that? How does everyone sort of turn on that moment? And I think that's an interesting way to kind of play around with creating a little bit of conflict in a family.
Yeah, you went into this in your book, Everything Isn't Terrible, where I can't remember which example, but when somebody finally started having more productive responses to the two less functional people in their family, it freaked everybody out and made everything harder immediately, even though it was the right course of action and eventually got there. But you're right that that's a nice, like, plot drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So something else you also mentioned was drawing this out, and you used the word genograms and, you know, triangles, and I think we're getting this picture of family trees and geometry. And so how might that work? What can we draw?
Well, you know, sometimes it's called a family diagram, sometimes it's called a genogram, but basically it's sort of a family tree that has the facts, but also has the sort of emotional processes. So, you know, and I recommended one book, it's called Genograms by Monica McGoldrick. It's the one that's sort of used when people take a family therapy class in grad school. But, you know, you can come up with your own symbols. It doesn't have to be, you know, the same technique. But, you know, if you're drawing conflict, drawing little lightning bolts, right? Or if there's cut off, you draw sort of, you know, a line and then another line that's perpendicular to show that gap, right? There's lots of different ways that you can do it. But it's sort of mapping the emotional history as well, looking at the triangles, you know, drawing a triangle between three people, right? And sort of looking at how that, but also the facts of the family, can kind of inform you as to how people act. Because I think that's useful to write down, you know, when did people die? What else was happening at the same time? When were people born? When did people get married? You know, did a bunch of people get married after the death of a parent, right? Like, you see that a lot of times in families. Or are there missing relatives or branches of a family tree that are sort of just big question marks? There's something about being able to see that on paper drawn out that really just adds another layer of complexity to thinking about the family. And I think it's such a useful tool to have as a writer. And maybe if people are inspired, they could do it with their own families.
Yeah, that sounds fun. Yeah. Or not.
But you don't know what you don't know until you draw it out, right? And I think it's useful to see what facts are missing. You know, do you not know about people's careers or their education level or illnesses, right? Or substance use issues or, you know, other where people lived, when they immigrated, right? Those are all useful facts to know.
Right. And you can get you can get a long way in fiction without knowing everything about your person. You know, and you can also get a long way down a rabbit hole by trying to write out everything about the person. But, you know, every time I create someone, and this is going to be more true for Serena because she's done it more, it's amazing how much I need to be able to go back and go, okay, wait a minute, you know, who was there? I mean, I can't even name them until I know who their parents are. Mm-hmm. Because parents give you, you know, you don't name your kid Karma unless you're a certain person, and you don't name your kid Fred unless you're a certain person. So, like, you're thrown right into it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, you don't have to have all of the information for every character. But I think if a character is missing information about themselves, that's important too. That shapes who you are also. So it's not just what they know and what's available to them and what you know as the writer. It's what's unknown as well and how that influences people.
Do you sometimes see authors sort of failing to take this stuff into account? Like, are you reading along and you're like, wait a minute. You don't have to name names. I'm just curious.
You know, I think the example that Serena gave about the crazy ex was such a good one, because I think what I see the most is just this incredible mishmash and sort of lopsidedness of maturity and functioning when we don't operate that way as humans, you know. It's not like, you know, someone, you know, and you see this a lot in literature, right? Someone has like a really, you know, terrible parent. It's, we paint, and then they're this, just this angel, right? Like, we paint things as heroes and villains, right? And it's much more complex than that. And so I think doing some of this thinking keeps you from falling into the trap of, you know, good person, bad person, victim, you know, hero, villain, right? Not that there aren't terrible people, but I think it just adds so much more to the story when you're able to see the interaction between people, and when you see the family as the unit and not just the individual, right? It helps you make people much more relatable, even if they're maybe not the greatest person in that story, but they're not just a straight up villain.
Right. You have to know where all that stuff comes from.
I think my downfall is sort of the opposite way. Like, I write really cerebral characters who can usually find the right way. And then I turn on the news and I'm like, wow, there's some nuts in the world.
Well, plus it's a problem because you don't want, like, and I do this all the time too. I'm like, and then they calmly and, you know, and rationally resolved the problem. And I'm like, no. That's because to some extent, you know, I guess you're writing what you would like to see happen, but it doesn't work. We need them to not calmly and rationally resolve the problem.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the only other thing I would add, and, you know, I talk a lot about this in the book, is that I think it's important to remember that people do what they do to calm things down to the best of their ability. People aren't just randomly throwing in bombs, right, to shake things up necessarily. And, you know, we've evolved that way for a reason. And it might seem very strange or upsetting or annoying to you, but if you can see it as sort of like just an adaptive thing that that person does to just deal with things the best that they know how, I think it allows you to be a little bit more empathetic towards that character and add a little bit more to that character than just someone who's just dropping in to wreak havoc, right? They're actually doing what they have been programmed to do as a human to try and get through a challenge.
Right. It's just important that it be wrong.
Yeah.
That sounds like a fun way to write a drama llama sibling.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, how has this become a person's way of dealing with the chaos?
Right.
Yeah. Why, you know, sure, they're always dropping, like you said, they're always lobbing bobs, but there's got to be a reason. There's got to be a reason why they are the way that they are.
Yeah.
Well, that, it's so helpful. And it is, I mean, it is a different way. I don't know. It's both a different way to think about it, and also it's a chance to broaden and deepen what we're creating in our fiction. And I don't think we should miss those. So this was really good. I like it. This is fun and smart and a great way to sort of create the dysfunctional family that you can manipulate, as opposed to living in the dysfunctional family that you're kind of stuck with. Right? Well, this is the part where we like to talk about the dysfunctional families that we're reading about, or functional, or whatever. And I forgot to warn you, but I know that you listen all the time, so hopefully you knew that we were going to ask you if you'd been reading anything good lately.
Yeah, I actually have, since my book has come out, I'm just letting myself read only romance, because that is just like a gift to me, and it's something I don't do a whole lot, so I've just really been enjoying reading tons of romance. And one that I've really enjoyed recently is Bringing Down the Duke by Evie Dunmore. I don't know if you guys have heard of that one. It's part of her series she's writing called A League of Extraordinary Women. And it's about sort of women revolved around sort of the suffrage cause in the UK. And so it's just a really fun, great romance, and I would recommend it.
You know, I haven't read her yet, but that book is getting a lot of chatter among my friends, so it's definitely on my list.
I, too, had heard it. I think I heard it probably on Book Riot, I think that they, which is a source of many, many, many book recommendations for me. Do not listen to the Book Riot podcasts unless you have a large budget of disposable income to just go and buy all the books, because that's what happens to me every single time. How about you, Serena? Have you read anything good lately?
I have a brand new book I'm about to start called 19 Love Songs by David Levithan. And David Levithan is a wonderful YA author who I have read, you know, pretty much everything he's written. And this is a special anthology coming out right now, which is Valentine's Day-ish, because he is so wonderful that he's written some extra stories. So I can't wait for 19 Love Songs.
I'm just looking through what I've been reading lately, and there has been, I've been reading a lot. Like, I have big stacks. And then, of course, the minute I get on the spot and I'm trying to figure out what it is that I read and what I enjoyed, I can't. So I'm in the middle of something that I love, but I'm going to wait and talk about it when I finish. And I'm going to tell you all, if you have not heard about it, I'm going to give you a pair of fun books that I read. One was Ex Libris, Confessions of a Common Reader by Anne Fadiman, and it's just a bunch of essays about reading. And the delight of that was that I had it on my Kindle, and I went to dinner by myself and foolishly grabbed only one book off of the stack of books that I had by the bedtime. I was taking a kid somewhere, and then I was going to just sit somewhere and eat and read. It was like going to be this great thing, right? And I opened the book, and I just couldn't. It was terrible, and I had nothing else. But fortunately, I had my iPad, and I had put Ex Libris on my Kindle, so I ended up having a really pleasant dinner, and that was fun. And then the other thing that just reminds me of it is a book, I don't think I've mentioned it before. It's called The Uncommon Reader, and it's a novella by Alan Bennett, and it is the story of what happens when the Queen of England begins to take a passionate interest in reading. And it is hysterical and beautiful and wonderful and very short. So I recommend it. And that's it. That's our show today.
KJ.
So what I wanted to... What?
Are you going to give a book away?
I am. Yes, right now. I'm ready.
I got nervous.
So what I wanted to say to everyone, I'm helpfully holding this up to the microphone, so I hope you can all see the adorable copy. We're going to give away a copy of Everything Isn't Terrible by Kathleen Smith, and you can read it for your own life and conquer your own insecurities and interrupt your own anxiety and finally calm down, or you can pretend that you only need it for fictional reasons and try to figure out ways to get your characters to conquer their insecurities. We are doing both, and we would love to give this away. And what I thought we would do is we will pull a name from our list of subscribers to the show notes. So if you are on our subscribers, if you get the podcast in your email every week, you are already entered. And if you don't, then you should go to amwritingpodcast.com and sign up to get the show notes every week. And they are more than show notes. It's always what we thought of the episode and all the links and all the books and usually some bonus lunacy, just because none of us is capable of writing anything straight up anymore. So that's the idea. Sign up. Maybe you'll get to win the book. All right. Serena, do you want to... Oh, but before we do, I want to thank you, Kathleen. This was great, and this was really fun. Where can people find you on all the social media and in all the places?
Yeah, the main place is my website, kathleensmith.net. I write a weekly newsletter called The Anxious Overachiever about my own efforts on myself and my work with clients that people might be interested in. Or they can catch me on Twitter at fangirltherapy.
And the book, again, is Everything Isn't Terrible. Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down by Dr. Kathleen Smith. Grab it. It is fun. And like I said, we can all just pretend that we're buying it for purely fictional reasons.
Yay.
That's our show this week. Yay. All right. You want to take us out, Serena?
I will. And thank you both. And until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
#AmWritingPodcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause, stop, stall.
Thank you.